beginning a new series today called The First Christmas. We're going to back up. We're not going to start at the manger scene. We're going to back up to the beginning, which is not far from the manger scene. But we're going to back up to the beginning of the New Testament. And we're going to be looking at the miracles that surround the events of the first Christmas and then how God intervenes in our life. This series begins at the beginning, and today's message begins with the first baby at the first Christmas. I would have to say, regardless of how predictable it is, the birth of a child, even if you have a scheduled C-section, the birth of a child is still one of life's greatest surprises. I mean, think about the change that comes into your life instantly. I remember when our first son was born, we got to the point where my wife was carrying the baby, and the baby had grown, and she was having Charlie horses in her calf muscles at night, and we thought, oh, if we could just get that baby out of there. And then that baby came out, and we thought, if we could just put that baby back in there. Because the change that comes in your life is startling and surprising. It's a very surprising time of life. Isn't it amazing how Christmas began with the birth of a child? Think about that. One of life's greatest surprises. And that's how God decided to enter the world. I can remember when our first son was born, we went to Lamaze class because we didn't know nothing. And what I mean by that is I mean no thing that we knew. And so we went to Lamaze class and did all that and learned to breathe and interrupt the nerve messages that go. And, you know, I learned to sympathize. I learned to sympathetically eat with my wife. You know, I never felt sympathy pains except in diet. Really felt those cravings to eat with her. She goes, you know what would sound good? Yes, I'll go get it. And I would say, we're pregnant. Can't you see? And so they taught us all these things about how you would know when it's true labor. And I can't remember, you know, the rules. They will not matter for me again. But I can remember my wife going into labor and us going through, she said, oh, this, I think I might be in labor and I don't know. And it was close to the date and all this. And we said, oh, no. It cannot be labor because whatever. And then she said, I mean, I really think this is labor. So we got the suitcase and jumped in the car and headed down to the hospital, Fort Lawton Beach Medical Center, 10:30 on Sunday night. We had had service all day and come in, and that Sunday night we head to the hospital. We get there, they check her, she's okay, she's slightly dilated, and no problem, and you're in labor, definitely in labor, and everything we learned in Lamaze was a lie, and they lied to us, and none of that matters, and I could have figured out how to breathe on my own. And so they gave her an epidural, and they turned the light off, and they said, now, it's going to be a really, really long night. It's about 11 o'clock by this time. Go to sleep. But if, now listen, sir, if your wife tells you she has the urge to push, you see this little button with the light on that says nurse, you push it, and you call us. Okay. Lights are off, we're laying there, we're just talking, you know, never had a baby before, staring at the ceiling in the dark, the hospital, thinking, boy, and they're thinking, wow, this is going to be great. We'll get to sleep, and then in the morning we'll wake up and have a baby. Be great. So we're laying there just talking, and she says, I just feel like I need to push. I said, isn't that great? It's incredible. Laying there, head stuck between those about 30 hospital pillows to get any elevation at all. We're sitting there, and she says about 3 minutes, I feel like I need to push. I said, you do, that's something. And neither one of us are aware of what's going on at all. And then about the third time, she said, I feel like I need to push. And I went, I said, what? You do what? You do what? She said, I feel like I need to push. And she said, then it said call the nurse. And I said, that's right. What are we doing? So we push the button, call the nurse. Nurse comes in there and check her. She is dilated from almost nothing to 8 centimeters in minutes. Minutes. Then they come in, they check. And I notice as they're checking, you have this young nurse in there, and she's looking funny. And she goes, uh-oh. What? What uh-oh? What's uh-oh? Then she leaves. Oh, you can't uh-oh and leave. Then she leaves. What is that about? And then she comes back with an older nurse, and she starts checking. And she goes, oh. What's oh? She said, the baby's breech. What? Yes, baby's breaching. You're going. Your labor is fast, and by this time she's nearly 10 centimeters. And said, we got to get that baby out now. We said, what does that mean? What do you do? Do you do the vacuum? How do you do that? And they said, we got to go to surgery now. I said, we didn't know nothing. And they whisk us in there, and I mean, in 15 minutes, we are in this stainless steel room. Doctors have come in, anesthesiologists, everybody that's on calls, blah, 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 they're all popping. And there's a whole crowded room full of people by about close to 12:30 now, midnight, 12:30, next morning, Monday morning. And they put all the little, you got to wear this to go in, and I'm putting it on as we go down the hallway, and they're rolling her. I mean, things are moving. It's like one of those soap opera, you know, things. We're moving. Music's playing in the back. We get into the room, and they've got this, it's like a tennis net that you can't see through, across her stomach there, and they're giving, just pumping her with these drugs, and they're doing stuff. They say, can you feel that? No. And I'm looking at it, I'm going, you can't feel that? I would die. And I'm sitting there right at the line. And I'm holding her hand, I'm, breathe. She goes, I can't feel anything. Okay, well. You should know how to breathe. That was another waste. So we're sitting there, and as we're going, and the doctors, and they let me go in and the whole thing, and the doctor's doing the deal, and they go to make the incision, and they said, now listen, you have to understand that when we pull the baby out, there's been some stress on the baby, and all his respiratory's clogged up, and he's not going to make any sound. It doesn't mean he's not okay. He's okay. We got a heartbeat. He's okay. He's not going to make any sound. But when he comes out, we're going to take him from here. They showed me right over the table, and we're going to vacuum that out, and then he's going to scream, and it'll be fine. You'll see. Okay, I'm cool. So they start to make the incision, and then they reach in, and they pull things out that's not a baby. And they set them up on the side. And I'm looking at her. She's just going. And I'm thinking, I have seen parts of my wife that no man should ever see. And I thought, oh, baby, you're going to be sore. They have moved stuff around, and I'm not sure they can get all that back. I mean, it's like a clown thing where they're pulling the handkerchiefs out. It just keeps coming. And then they pull the baby out, and I look, and I go, oh, look, the baby's head. Look, the baby's head's coming out, and they pull it out, and it's his rear end. And there were so many jokes that come to mind at that moment about whose side of the family takes after and all that. But I thought, this is not appropriate right now. So I just held it. And they pull the baby out and back that little guy out of there. And the whole thing's going on. I keep standing up like this. And the guy beside me, he'd put his hand on my shoulder and put me down. Then I'd stand, I would float. I wouldn't even know I was standing. And he'd push me down. He said, listen. We've had people collapse on this concrete floor. Now, you've got to sit down. Okay. Let's stand back up. Push me back down. I mean, I'm into this. And they keep backing the baby up, and there's this little, then his back comes out, and then I see his little back of his head and his legs, and pull him out of there. And all of a sudden, they pull him out. He goes, blah, blah, blah. And that thing has been crying like that ever since. Tell me he didn't cry. They didn't know who they were dealing with. Isn't it something how a baby, regardless of how it enters the situation, brings a phenomenal surprise? That must be, it must tell us something about the Christmas season that we're entering. When is the last time you were really surprised? When we look for God, God oftentimes surprises us, doesn't he? We look for him in the front door and he comes in the back. Those moments that we think that God will surely God's going to intervene and do something about this. And sort of like when Lazarus had passed away, he just said, I'll be there in a little while. He doesn't jump in. And then those moments that we think, you know what, Jesus is surely just going to steer around this and he's going to sit on the side and he's not going to get involved in this. And then he leaps into the temple and starts flipping tables over and whipping cats of nine tails all over the room. and you say, wow, I didn't see that coming. Jesus constantly kept his disciples, the crowds, the Pharisees off balance. Can't count God out of any situation. In Matthew 19:26, Jesus said, with God, all things are possible. Can you imagine what it must have felt like when after 400 years of silence, God began to speak again? Think about it. After hundreds of years, thousands of years of history, prophet after prophet, king after king, story after story, Abraham, Isaac, Moses, Noah, Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, Samuel, Saul, David, Solomon, Jeremiah, Isaiah, Daniel, Hosea. And think about all the prophecies that are interwoven in the fabric of the Old Testament. Prophecies about the Messiah that would come one day, who would be the chief cornerstone, the bright and the morning star. We sang about it this morning, who is the Prince of Peace. And then all the miracles that flooded the Old Testament, the parting of the Red Sea so that the children of Israel could walk across on dry land. The cloud by day that would lead them and the fire by night that would lead them even in the middle of the night. Rescuing Isaac from being sacrificed at the altar. Moses, who was put in a little crib and floated down river and ended up being the leader that he was. The world that was saved by an ark. Daniel, who was saved in the lion's den. Moses, who delivered the people to the promised land. Queen Esther, who God put for such a time as this to deliver the Jews from the hands and the plan of Haman. David, who led the nation to victory. All the history, all the prophecies, all the foreshadowing, all the miracles, all the priests, all the prophets, all the kings. Human history itself had anticipated for thousands of years the time when Jesus would come and save people. And at the end of all that, what do you think came next? Surprise. A blackout. For 400 years, we have no message from God. This surge of seismic activity in the heavenlies, in the supernatural, in the earth, in writings, in teachings, in conversation, around campfires from grandfathers to grandsons. This thing had been passed on, and then all of a sudden, for 400 years, we have an absolute, complete blackout. There's a 400-year gap between the last book of the Old Testament and the first book of the New Testament. From Malachi to Matthew, there's a 400-year gap. If God communicated in any way, we don't know how, and we have no idea what He said. But there's a surprise. Don't ever count God out, regardless of how long you've waited. Don't ever lose your expectation that this could be the day, this could be the year, this could be the moment, this could be the Christmas, this could be the time. Don't lose your expectation that God could slip in a moment and change everything. After 400 years of silence in one dramatic moment, God slipped into the world and began to speak. And after all that time, where do you think He would start? Well, look at Luke chapter 1, verse 6 and 7, and leave your Bible open there to Luke chapter 1. We're going to read several verses through the first Christmas story. Both of them were upright. This story is about a man named Zechariah and Elizabeth. Both of them were upright in the sight of God, observing all the Lord's commandments and regulations blamelessly, but they had no children because Elizabeth was barren. And they were both well along in years. Where do you think after 400 years of total silence God would start to speak? He started with an older couple whose chances of ever having a baby had probably already died. He started with an ordinary priest and his wife, and I'll show you in just a minute how ordinary he really was. This is the New Testament version of Abraham and Sarah, who were already past years. For Elizabeth, each fruitless month that passed must have taken another part of her heart. Maybe next month. But as the months passed and turned into years, her hopes must have worn out. The salt in the wound must have been the nagging question, why? Why? In Elizabeth's day, it was held, if God gave you children, it was a sign that He had blessed you because you had served Him well. That was the cultural thought. If God gave you a child, it's because you had served Him well, and it was a blessing on your life for the way you served Him. Can you imagine the gossip that must have circulated about Elizabeth? I wonder what she's done wrong. I wonder what God's punishing her for. I wonder what secret sin that couple is doing that we don't know about, but God has withheld a baby from them. To add pressure to the storm that must have raged, a Jewish woman who could not have a child was grounds for divorce. So she must have wondered in her mind and lived in fear, I wonder when Zechariah is going to divorce me. I wonder when he's going to put me aside and go get another wife. I wonder how long he's going to endure this. He has a legal right to divorce me. That might have been balanced by the other extreme, where she just felt guilt and thought, why doesn't he just go ahead and divorce me and get it over with and move on with his life? Who would have ever imagined in their foggiest thought that this aging, heartbroken couple, that God would plant the seed for hope, the hope of the world inside of them? But surprise, after 400 years, God started to speak right there. The first Christmas had a first baby. And I want to share with you from Zechariah and Elizabeth's story. If you're taking notes, grab a pen and something to write on. Let me give you three thoughts from the first baby at the first Christmas. Here's number one. Impossible situations are where God does His best work. Impossible situations are where God does His best work. Verse 8 and 9 sets the scene for the story. Once when Zechariah's division was on duty and he was serving as priest before God, he was chosen by lot. Now I'll explain that. He was chosen by lot, according to custom of the priesthood, to go into the temple of the Lord and burn incense. In Zechariah's time, the priesthood was enormous. There were 20,000 priests. Now think about what all this means. 20,000 priests divided up into 24 divisions that made the priesthood. Each division was on duty twice a year for a full week. During one of Zechariah's weeks of temple duty, he was chosen to burn incense. Now, this isn't important to us, but you have to understand to Zechariah, he's now an old man. He had probably, not probably, statistically, it's impossible for him to ever have been chosen before to burn incense in the holy place. Many priests would spend their entire lifetime and the lot would never fall on them. It would never be their turn. 20,000, 24 divisions. Twice a year, your division would go in. Many priests would start their journey in the priesthood and die of old age and never have gone into the temple and burned incense. Zechariah, the lot had fallen on him, and it was an enormous honor, a once-in-a-lifetime honor. So Zechariah is chosen to enter the temple and to offer a sacrifice, to offer incense. And as he walked toward the temple, the sacrificed animal was outside. People had gathered around as they normally did. Zechariah was to enter the holy place completely alone, no one with him. Once he was there, he was to pour incense over a live coal on the altar. He had looked forward to this moment his entire life. And as he stood there in the sacred chamber all by himself, he carefully observed every step of the process, thinking, this is my one time to even see inside this room. He didn't want to mess anything up. So methodically, he worked through the process. As he approached the altar, waves of heat rose from the glowing embers. Impassioned prayers must have just fallen off of his lips. He prayed for Israel. He prayed for his family. He prayed for himself. He prayed for his wife. No doubt, as any priest would, he prayed that the Messiah, that Jesus, would come and save Israel. With one motion, he lifted a container and poured out the incense over the coals, enveloping him in the steam that rose off the altar, and his petitions floated up into a billowing cloud. Suddenly, something happened that Zechariah could have never foresaw. Standing there in that moment, an angel appeared to Zechariah and startled him. And the angel was no second-class angel. It was Gabriel, who had entered the holy place and met Zechariah in the one day he would ever enter the holy place in his life. The angel said that his prayer would be answered and he would have a son. Can you imagine this? This older man and his older wife who had lived all these years barren, and the angel appears to him in the one day in his entire life he'd be in the holy place and says, you're going to have a son. And the angel said, and your son will be great in God's sight, and many people will rejoice because of his birth. Imagine this. Zechariah's prayers answered on the only day in his life that he'd ever enter the holy place. What a surprise. And then in verse 17 and 18, the angel continues to speak. And he will go on before the Lord in the spirit and power of Elijah to turn the hearts of the fathers to their children and the disobedient to the wisdom of the righteous, to make ready a people prepared for the Lord. Zechariah asked the angel, how can I be sure of this? I'm an old man and my wife is well along in years. Let's take each one of those verses one at a time. This is a very specific thought that the angel is speaking to Zechariah. He will go on before the Lord in the spirit and power of Elijah to turn the hearts of their fathers to their children. Where have we heard that before? That is a direct quote. Now listen to me. That is a direct word-for-word quote. You can look it up yourself from the last verse of the last chapter of the last book of the Old Testament. The very last verse in the book of Malachi, which is the last book of the Old Testament, right, the moment just before God blacked out for 400 years, before there was no communication from God to man for 400 years, it is the last word, and it is the first word the angel gives to Zechariah. Think about the power of this. You know that Zechariah, being his age, he knew the book of Malachi. He knew what the angel was saying. The last word spoken again. And Zechariah has to begin to think, you mean my son will be the one that will come in the spirit of Elijah, the one who will turn the hearts of the fathers back to their children? Zechariah then in verse 18 though said, how will I know for sure? Really? You're in the holy place, and the only day in your life you're ever going to be in it, an angel appears to you and quotes the last verse of the Old Testament, and you have the gall to say, I don't know what's going to happen for sure. I don't know for sure. Is this not enough? An angel enters the holy place and talks to you. It almost seems like Zechariah says, wait a minute. Why me? I mean, why now? Why after 400 years? Why would I be the one? How could it really be true? You know, I've known people in my life who've suffered for so long that they're more comfortable with suffering and tragedy than they are with freedom. And they're slow to let go because it's predictable. Because it's secure in that it won't change. They can count on it to be the same. Tragedy has become their friend. And they're so comfortable with suffering, they won't allow themselves to live in blessing. You know that, we've all heard that thought that when someone sort of goes above their own opinion of themselves, they'll unconsciously sabotage themselves to come back down. Because their mental outlook, their mental view, their mental definition, their mental identity is at a certain level, and they'll sabotage themselves if they rise any higher than that. And even though it's time, and even though it's best, and even though sometimes God is leading, people have a hard time sometimes letting go and leaving because they'd rather stick with what's predictable. And I've watched people refuse God's blessing because it required them to think or to act or to live for or believe different than the experiences of their life have taught them to believe. If you're not facing an impossible situation, you're not even a candidate for a miracle. You don't need one. Impossible situations are where God does His best work. Number two, God's delays are not necessarily His denials. God's delays are not necessarily His denials. This was an angel who spoke, an archangel. He came with a message from God. He physically appeared to Zechariah, and Zechariah is a lot like we are. He was a priest. He was a religious man. He's been around the block in this spiritual stuff a time or two. And I know he was thinking, I know how people are. They claim everything under the sun is God's leading. I've watched them make fools of themselves. Not me. Before I hang my neck out on this one and walk out of the holy place and say, guess what? While I was in there offering incense, an angel appeared to me and said, Elizabeth, you and I are going to have a baby. Before I go do something stupid, I just want to make sure. And I know when I go out there, if I tell them that, you know what they're all going to say? They're going to say, oh, well, of course, everybody who's never, you're probably overwhelmed because of the atmosphere. You're overwhelmed because you were in the holy place. You're overwhelmed by the incense. You're overwhelmed by the moment. You got carried away. It can't really be true. So as Zechariah stands there, he says, I need an upfront deposit. I need a down payment on this. Well, that angel standing there looks pretty smart. Let me ask him. How can I be sure? Now listen, listen very carefully. Zechariah says in verse 18, I am old. Now listen to this. He identifies himself. I am what? How would you complete that sentence for yourself? I am what? He says, I am old and my wife is old. And he focused on his limitations and his own experience. And in his mind, I know he's thinking, I've been through this 100 times. I've been through it with my wife. We thought this was going to, we thought she was pregnant. We thought she was pregnant. We thought she was pregnant. She's not pregnant. We thought it was going to happen. It never happened. And somewhere along the line of life, life taught us to give up and let go and forget it. And it's never going to happen. And now I've become older and cynical. Because life has taught me that it's not going to happen. And he identified with who he was. But look at verse 19 and verse 20. The angel counters Zechariah's doubt. The angel answered, I am. Zechariah says, I am old. The angel says, I am Gabriel. I stand in the presence of God, and I have been sent to speak to you and to tell you this good news, and now you will be silent and not able to speak until the day this happens because you did not believe my words, which will come true at their proper time. Gabriel counters Zechariah's I am with an I am of his own. Gabriel says, I'm Gabriel. I stand in the presence of God. He sent me to speak to you and to bring you good news. Gabriel focused on the commission from God, the message from God, and God's unlimited power. When you fill that blank in about yourself, how do you fill it in? I am what? Do you say I am and then the next thought is your limitation? Do you say I am and the next thought is what life has taught you, your experience? Is that what you are? What are you identifying yourself by? Your limitation, your experience, or God's word and God's power? Basically, he was saying, I was sent to tell you this good news, but since you didn't believe me, you're not going to talk again until the baby's born. Now, that sounds funny to me. Can you imagine? Think about it. He's the only one in the room. The angel didn't give this message to anybody else. So he goes in talking to his wife. Oh, this is the greatest day of my life. I'm going to go in the temple and I'm going to offer incense. I'll never get to do this again. And then he comes out going, And she says, what happened to you? And he goes, You ate too much? Can you imagine month after month of him like doing human videos and panda minds and stuff? Trying to get them to understand you're going to have a baby. Not able to speak for 9 months. Then all of a sudden the baby pops up and he says, it's a baby. And they said, yeah. We've known that. But he knew it there. God's delays are not necessarily God's denials. But you identify with his word and his power, not with your experiences and your circumstances. Here's the last one. God's surprises are always for his glory and for our good. God's surprises are always for his glory and our good. I'm going to ask the worship team to come. God used this child to usher in a new age. But he also gave Zechariah and Elizabeth to the desires of their heart. They wanted a baby. Isn't it something how God can do both? He can do both. He can somehow do what's best for us and advance his kingdom at the same time. And it is absolutely miraculous. Do you remember there was another mother in Scripture who wanted a baby? Hannah, and the Bible said that she would go in the temple and she would pray to the point that her lips would move and nothing would come out. She would just weep. But God sent Hannah a child named Samuel, and he became the prophet that anointed David king, that anointed Saul, who lived a fruitful and a powerful life in ministry. And God gave Hannah the desires of her heart, and he forwarded the kingdom at the same time. God gave Zechariah and Elizabeth the desire of their heart, and their baby was John the Baptist, who was the forerunner of Jesus, who was sent to earth to tell everybody at the first Christmas, Jesus is coming. Get ready. Surprise. 400 years. You've waited and you've tarried and you've wondered and you've passed the stories along and you've read the scripture and you've burned the incense. And at the beginning of this story, the Bible says that Zechariah and Elizabeth had lived blameless before God. They were holy people. They were good people. But God still moved in with a surprise and said, surprise. 400 years has ended. You have a baby, and heaven has a prophet. And he'll come and prepare the way for Christmas. Maybe today you need a miracle. Maybe today you're at a point. You know, there's something about the holidays that are both refreshing and restful. And at the same time, they can be very dry and weary. Sometimes when we withdraw from our routines, we get busy doing all the other things, shopping till you drop and eating till you pass out, all that stuff. And those times are wonderful, and being with family is a gift. It's a precious God-given gift. Sometimes in those moments, what gets squeezed out is the anticipation that we have a God who still intervenes. Let me give you my definition of Christmas. Let me just give you, if you want to write it down, be something good to think about the next 3 or 4 or 5 weeks. Christmas means God still does miracles. What it means. And as we enter this season and celebrate it, I'm going to ask you to pray and receive that thought. Christmas means God still does miracles. Would you stand with me this morning? I'm going to ask our prayer team to come.